It's a privilege for me to be in the pulpit today. The first time I was in a UU pulpit was in 1971. This is the eighth time in pulpits in Tennessee, Mississippi, and Virginia. That's once every 6 years, so I'm asking the worship associates to put me down for 2026. But in all eight times, I have never been in the pulpit with my minister in the audience, so I bow to the minister. It was obvious because the minister was not available. But I understand she's very forgiving, so it's okay. I have picked a few communication themes that are very easy to understand in theory, but the ideas in it require constant practice. I do believe that I struggle with implementing these in my own life and don't always succeed. These are critical in building a true community, whether we are inside a congregation, amongst a group of friends, in a community of a social community, or even in a corporation. I want to start with a quote from Zen Master Shunryu Suzuki. He's a Zen monk. He said, "All of us are perfect just as we are, and we could use a little improvement." The first theme I want to talk about is about ladders of inference. Here's what I mean. The ladder works in this order. We see something. We perceive something. We describe that in our own mind. Then we add meaning to it. We evaluate it. Then we draw conclusions from it. It prompts feelings. We make a judgment, and then we act. So this is sort of the process of getting to judgment from perception. There are times that we have to act in a microsecond. If you see a child running in front of a car, you don't want to go through this process. You want to grab the child away from the car so the child is saved. But there are often times we need to slow the process down. If you look at the cover of the order of service that has these steps laid out, there's a reason why the font sizes are different, and it sort of says that judgment should be very few times compared to when you see something, perceiving, describing things to yourself. I'll give you an example. What do I mean? It is, I had an older relative who said this to me many years ago. So-and-so cousin was in India, and he did not bother to call me. That was a statement, that he did not bother to call me, quote unquote. Well, I said, okay, I just left it at that. And then when I actually saw this cousin, he said, you know, I was in Bombay, it was raining hard, and I tried to call this relative 25 times, and I could not get through. This is before cell phones and all that. So you see the difference between saying, I did not receive a phone call, to he did not bother to call me. Big difference in that. So we are better off in not jumping to conclusions too quickly, not evaluating and judging too quickly, and following the graphic that's on the front page. And a wonderful friend of mine, Molly Catron, who is a chemist in my company, but then got a degree in storytelling and is a master storyteller. She has a story called Dave's Story that Kim and Denise are going to do that illustrates this idea of not reaching judgment too quickly.
Well, I had been given the good guy, bad guy list. I really didn't want it, and I knew I shouldn't look at it, but I did anyway. Dave was on the bad guy list, and in the first weeks I managed the group, he validated that designation. Well, we were working in teams with the members, and we were expected to share functions of the team, leading, taking minutes, planning the agenda, so on. Well, if I asked to lead the meeting, he turned every agenda item into fodder for his comedy routine. He would conveniently forget to send out minutes, saying he was too busy for that kind of stuff. Then he would con a teammate into doing it for him. Dave's mission was clear to me. It wasn't just to reject responsibility. His mission was to completely disrupt the team's meetings. He would prop himself up in the corner of the meeting room, and his feet would be up on the end of the table. His chair was perched precariously on two legs. With his baseball hat pulled down low over his eyes, he gnawed on a chaw of tobacco, and he locked securely in the corner of his mouth, and he filled the picture with the spit cup held in the ready position. The see-through kind, my favorite. Well, as the meeting proceeded, he would mumble under his breath, just loud enough for those close by to hear. He was countering comments I made. Each mumble was followed by a series of sideways glances and subdued laughter from his fellow teammates. Speaking up was not his problem. He dominated the meeting, but unfortunately, never with valuable input, just distraction. At the end of each meeting, he'd give me a smirk, establishing himself as the winner of the power struggle for the attention of the group. For a year and a half, I attempted to coach Dave on his disruptive behavior. The only thing that changed was the depth of my resentment for this guy. He had secured a place on my bad guy list. Where was this guy's character? He was a bad apple, for sure. We can't have those kind of employees around here anymore. He was a non-team player. I had him figured out, and he wasn't going to get away with his plan to take over control of the group. After all, I was the boss. I had the boss card. So I called him into my office and followed the correct procedure for putting an employee in an official performance improvement plan. That's the terminology for the party's over. Shape up, or we'll free your future. I have the boss card. Now make my day. I clearly defined what my expectations were for his behavior in the team meetings. He had 3 months to show an improvement. If he didn't improve, he'd be placed on final warning, given another 3 months to improve. If he didn't improve, he'd be fired, axed, terminated. I asked if you understood these expectations. He nodded. He left. The power position had changed. I showed him who was really the power. An hour went by, and then my phone rang. It was Dave. He asked if I would come to his work area. He said he needed to talk to me. I told him I would be there. I hung up the phone, brushed off my boss card for another challenge. He's just a bad seed, not worth the powder it would take to shoot him, as my grandpa used to say. Totally incorrect language for today, but there you go. Troublemaker, non-team player. You gotta do what you gotta do. Dave was sitting quietly at his desk. The defiant demeanor was absent. His eyes looked weak and red. He sat with slumped shoulders. He offered me a chair next to him. After I was situated, he pulled his chair into a position facing mine and moved in until our knees almost touched. He leaned towards me and he began to speak. Tears welled in his eyes.
I like my job. I think you have tried to be fair to me, and I understand what you want me to do, but I can't do it.
The dam of tears broke and flowed down his face as he told me why. There was a long silence, and in a much too small voice, he said,
I can't read and write well enough to do what you want me to do.
He went on to tell me how hard it was to admit to that fact. His parents were good people, but uneducated. They didn't understand the importance of reading and writing. Never disciplined him to study and learn. He worked on the farm. When he got too big and too old, he was given a diploma to get rid of him. He'd been hiding the secret all during his 21-year career at Company X. He had taken several demotions to protect his secret. Every time someone would begin to suspect something, he would run. His voice cracked as he bowed his head and said,
My teenage daughters don't even know it.
He ended by saying,
Will you help me?
I sat stunned. I saw a different part of this man, his heart, his motive. The troublemaking bad seed who was a non-team player suddenly revealed his heart, his pain, his secret to me. I cried too. I cried more for me than I did for Dave. I'd sat on my self-righteous seat and judged his motive. I'd been the jury, arrogantly holding his future in my hands and had never asked why. I had pronounced him bad, reject, no good. I'd never asked why, or even thought to ask why. Despite all of that, he chose to ask me for help. He trusted me. I cried more. There's a good ending. I helped Dave, got him some tutoring, bought him an electronic spelling dictionary, the kind that gives you spelling if you just get a little part of the word right and gives you the definition. It helped his vocabulary. I checked the minutes he wrote for the team before he sent them out. He learned quickly. The secret no longer held him in bondage. I too learned quickly. It was one of the days in my life that changed me forever. When I observe anyone's behavior now, the first word flashing in my mind is why. Is it pain? A struggle? Some hurt? Am I assuming the motive? Can I see the heart beyond the protective smokescreen? Would someone do the same for me? Would you do the same for me? I saw Dave a few weeks ago. He said,
"Are you still telling him my story?"
I said, "Yeah, it's my favorite story. It's about a hero of mine." He hugged me. Then he said,
"Will you tell him I just got another promotion? I am the maintenance supervisor for the whole building."
As he walked away, he turned and said,
"And I gotta give you my email address. I love them computers. I got pen pals all over the world. And you know, I'm thinking about learning French."
Thank you. Thank you. And the wonderful thing about this story is that it's real. There's a person by the name of Dave, and Molly was his supervisor, so it's not a fiction. The second theme I want to talk about is from Scott Peck's book called The Different Drum, which is my favorite Peck book. I mean, The Road Less Traveled is better known, but The Different Drum is my favorite. Peck writes about pseudo-community, or a pretense of a community, that the pseudo-communities are conflict-avoiding, true communities are conflict-resolving. A diagnostic of pseudo-community is minimization or lack of acknowledgement or ignoring of individual differences. Essential dynamic in a pseudo-community is conflict avoidance. A characteristic of a pseudo-community is people will let each other get away with universal generalizations. Scott Peck illustrates this with an example of a group he was facilitating. There was a group in which a woman said to the group, "Divorce is a terrible thing that can happen to any human being." And at that point, there was silence in the group. People were fidgety and uncomfortable. And then Scott Peck says, "Is that what you meant to say? Or did you mean to say that divorce was a terrible personal experience for you?" And she thought about that and said, "Yes, I was devastated. I did not expect it. It was terrible for me." The moment she went from a generalization that is a universal truth to a personalization that is her truth, it just changed the dynamic in the room. Somebody tapped on her back and said, "I'm so sorry this happened to you, but I was in a terrible marriage, and it's the best thing that ever happened to me." And so the point of the story is a skill that we can develop that personalizes us, what our observations are, and not sweeping generalization, like, "This is a terrible movie." Well, "I didn't like that movie" is different from "This is a terrible movie." So it's a way of expressing ourselves that allows a different person with a different viewpoint to come in and add to it without feeling like you're banging your head against that person. So theme is to avoid universalization and go for personalization of what you say. A third theme that I want to talk about is Covey's ideas regarding emotional bank account. Emotional bank account is a metaphor for to measure someone else's trust in us. It measures how dependably other people feel in our presence. He talks about six different ways of emotional bank account, but I'm going to talk about one aspect which is critical in building community. Covey says that the most important way to manifest integrity is to be loyal to those who are absent, those who are not in our presence. What does that mean? In doing so, we build trust of those who are present. When we defend those who are absent, we retain trust of those who are present. In talking to you, if I'm constantly critical of someone else who is not there, you might think that I'll be critical of you when you are not there. And so the idea is to say that, you've seen me be critical of others, so you're probably critical of me elsewhere. There's a very well-known UU minister who became president of UUA, Reverend John Burens. He says, you take the simple business of differences of opinion within a community. Suppose you're talking to a fellow congregant. He or she is upset about something in the congregation, and it involves a third party. Here's what Reverend Buren suggests you should ask in response. Have you talked to the person directly? If not, what could we do to help you talk to that person directly? Do you need to practice talking to that person? If you are uncomfortable going to that person to talk to him, can I go with you to talk to him? These are all sort of choices that go down the line. Can I go with you and I'll be with you when you talk to that person? Or alternately, and the last one, but it's still better than the other way, is may I convey your concern to that person with your name so that person can contact you directly? Will you agree not to talk about this until you've addressed it directly with that person? Following these guidelines would help foster the right relationships within any community. The fourth theme is we can be efficient with tasks or effective with people. We cannot be efficient with people. We often try to be efficient with people and we are not effective. I'll illustrate this theme with an example in a group meeting. Long time ago, there was an issue in a UU congregation where the congregation wanted to reverse direction of that what they had chosen. And about 75% of the people agreed with the reversal of the direction. But that left 25% of us in a minority. As soon as the congregation, and I had prepared a 5-minute statement on behalf of the minority, as soon as the congregational meeting started, somebody passed, efficient parliamentarians passed a resolution limiting any comments to 3 minutes. So I ended up cutting my comments and giving somebody else the other 3 minutes to finish up. But that was a negative experience for me, and I became less active, my pledging reduced, I felt like I was being silenced. Not because the minority was lost, but because the minority was not allowed to speak its mind. It is so important for that. So in that sense, I'm not a big fan of Robert's Rules of Order. Robert's Rules of Order are around efficiency, not effectiveness. Anybody can say, I call the question, and nobody, it just stops the debate and kills it, and you have to vote on it. I think rather than that, I'd like for meetings to think about, what do I need to do to ensure that those who are in a minority will stay in our community after this decision is made? That is a very important thing, and we saw a really good example of that happening when we wanted to change artwork here in this building, where we had multiple meetings to talk about it rather than simply take a vote. It was pretty clear that the vote would have been to change the art. But having those meetings was important to keep those who did not believe in that sense, in that whole aspect of it. How do I listen to people who are in the minority more deeply? We have to continually think about that rather than what's the will of the majority. Will of the majority will be done, but how it is done is important to keep everybody on board. I'm personally very interested in hearing stories about consensus decision-making in intentional communities that Reverend Aileen is so familiar with. I'd love to hear stories about how decisions are made in those communities, because I think that's important in keeping everybody together rather than people get upset at this or that and drift away from the community. The fifth theme I want to talk about is sort of like almost like sacrilegious. I'm going to talk against the golden rule. So the golden rule says, do unto others as you would do as you would want them to do unto you. Every religion says that. And that is really a good rule on the very basic things of human nature. I don't like to be yelled at, and we can assume that nobody likes to be yelled at. I don't like somebody to slap me, but you can assume nobody else likes that. So it works with a very basic rule, but in a sense, it tells us, I don't have to get to know you, because what you want is what I want. You know, I don't have to get to know you. So there is actually such a thing, if you can Google it, there's a platinum rule that goes beyond that goes beyond the golden rule. It says, do unto others as they would have them do unto them. Do unto others as they would have them do unto them. This works better because, first of all, it forces you to get to know people. It forces you in a community to get to know people. Very simple example. I love to be hugged, but not everybody likes to be hugged. And if I assume that everybody likes what I like, I'll go hugging people that may not appreciate it. But how would I know that somebody doesn't like to be hugged? Well, I have to engage in a deeper conversation with that person. My sense is that our pastoral care team, whoever they are, they do a very good job of this in that they try to understand what the needs of lay pastoral care needs are of people. There are people who want to have visitors when they're sick, and there are people who want to be left alone when they're sick. The people want to have visitors in the hospital, people want to be left alone in the hospital. So the pastoral care team, I assume, Bonnie, they are trying to understand what the premises are rather than saying, well, I want 10 visitors in the hospital, so you'll want everybody showing up. Patnaik and Mortensen define empathy as the human capacity to step outside our own perspective, to see the world through the eyes of others, capacity hardwired by nature. So in understanding illnesses, there's some people who want to have their sorrows shared and some people don't. So we have to understand that also. So those are the themes I wanted to talk about, and thank you for listening. And I would like to see if there are some comments in the coffee hour. We won't have time during the service, but I would also like to see if there's enough interest that we can set up intentional ad hoc groups to talk in depth about principles of what we do in trying to build a community. So that's something that I would offer up, that if you want to have smaller group meetings, we should have them or after the coffee hour.
Can we do a class?
Possible. More in depth, yeah. Thank you very much.